another exciting episode of Extra Features Podcast. We have a fabulous guest whose last name I didn't even ask how to say, but I'm going to guess anyway. Gabriel Thesis?
Tice.
Tice?
Yeah,
like I'm ice. So bad at this. I really should be fired, but he showed up anyway. He's out of luck. His film, Curse of Professor Zargonagus, he's here to discuss. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
You made it fresh off Armageddon, Snowageddon. You're here. So let's start right at the beginning of the film. Why a documentary feature?
Well, so the whole idea of the project started out, I thought it was just going to be a little short film that I would do with my friends. I imagined that I would be the cameraman to this fictional little documentary, and the subject would be someone who is searching for a fictional, like, I was just trying to imagine, like, what scenario would be so ridiculous and we could get so much comedy out of it. So I thought, well, if there was somebody who's trying to look for this ridiculous urban legend, and I was the cameraman filming this almost like a parody of one of those kind of, you know, one of those shows where they go out looking for all these kind of fantastical things. That was the genesis of the project. And then, you know, I kept writing down ideas for this one idea. And pretty soon I realized, you know, I don't have just like a short something. I might actually have a feature length movie on my hands, because I was also starting to think about the psychology of the characters involved. Like, what would drive a person to be so devoted to the search of such a bizarre legend? You know, what's the psychology behind that character? So that's when I realized that, okay, maybe we have a movie. And then, you know, we kept the documentary format just for the simplicity of the production and everything, but also to kind of enhance the, let's say, more authentic qualities of the characters, right?
I thought it would argue that it was easier for you to do a documentary film because it looks like you spent very little money on the film. Not that there's an issue with that. Just, I mean, independent film, you have a budget. You can't go over that budget anyway. There's nobody going to bail you out. So to me, every location was done cheaply, I would presume. And that's why you went with the documentary feature. Am I wrong here?
No, that was a big part of it. I mean, anytime you're making an independent film, you have to ask the question of, how am I going to do this? What do I have at my disposal? How can I make this work? And you just have to be honest with yourself. You have to be honest about your limitations. I was a senior in college when I made this movie. I knew that I wouldn't have the budget or the time to make a traditionally shot feature film. So I got some colleagues of mine together. We'd just done another short film, and I presented them with the script. I told them the format, and they were like, okay, let's go. You know, we crowdfunded $3,500. We're working below micro budget, really. Like, that's virtually no budget. We were able to pay our crew and cast. We were able to, you know, there's a shot of these scars on a character's arm, right? We were able to pay a makeup artist for that. But really, it's like basically no budget. So the choice to do found footage absolutely also came with that. I just tried to make sure it was justified creatively as well as, you know, like practically.
So where's the title of the film come from? Like, Zargonagus is a pretty long name, and yeah, probably some people have problems saying it occasionally. Where does that name come from? What were you reading, or did you just make it up out of your head?
So I wanted a name that just sounded, for lack of a better word, goofy, right? You just see that name and you just know you're in for like some kind of, you know, humorous, something like just strange, you know? And I think where the name Zardonicus comes from is the word sardonic, you know, which means, you know, that's like a type of humor that is particularly dark or kind of weird or esoteric. I didn't think critically about where the name came from, but there's also a film called Mr. Sardonicus, which we reference in our movie. And that, I don't know if I've heard that name before. I've been wondering, maybe that was somewhere back here in my subconscious, but Zardonicus just is what it is, you know? It's hard to tell exactly where it came from.
So I want to go to your crowdfunding just very briefly. I thought it was surprising you didn't offer any T-shirts. You offered your short film that I didn't get to see for some reason. You didn't send it to me. But the thing I did want to discuss to go over is a Skype call somebody purchased with you for half an hour. Mm-hmm. How did that go?
Well, that went fine. I mean, that person already knew us. They chose to purchase a tier. We had a wonderful conversation with them. It wasn't a stranger, so it wasn't anything like that. It was very, very nice talk with somebody who knew us, and we just talked about the making of the film and everything like that. So,
little do you know, I did also do more research on the posters. Was it a fully signed cast poster, or was it just yourself and the other lead?
So that the posters were signed by myself, my other lead, Alec White, my director of photography, Lucio Vasquez, and the actress who plays my character's girlfriend. Her name is Kat Thomas. Yes. So the four of us signed the posters.
See, I'm going to get these details out of you because I do research. So how did you get your locations? I mean, you have a micro budget. I'm sure you have no money to offer these people. You have a house location, a church, and an apartment. So whose friends did you use?
We just used every friend available, really. I mean, I wrote the script knowing that I wouldn't be able to get certain locations. Like, I was going through a list of, okay, what do I have access to? That church that is featured, that's the church that my family goes to, and they were very accommodating, very happy for us to film there. I was going to college at the time, so 70% of the movie is set just on that college campus. The apartment that you see that my character's in, that is Kat's apartment, the actress's apartment. So, you know, you just ask people for favors, you know. Thankfully, we were very lucky. People were very happy to accommodate us and help us out, you know, in the making of this film. So, you know, you just go through your resources.
Now, there's a scene that takes place in the apartment. Did you plan on going in the closet, or was that just happenstance?
Oh no, I planned for that. That was that was a screenwriting bit that I thought of while writing that scene. There was some improvisation and everything, taking advantage of new things in the environment, but the major things were scripted. You know, major scripted beats were scripted.
I do want to discuss the forest scene very briefly. How did you set that up? Did somebody just pull up in a van and you guys laid out a bunch of stuff and said, okay, we're going to shoot here? Or how does that all concept come to be?
Well, so that's an interesting thing. Originally, for context here, you know, my character and the other lead character go out into the woods to meet this man. In the script, this man was living in a cabin. He was living in a regular cabin out in the woods. We could not get a cabin. That just never worked out. You know, we tried and tried and tried. And at some point I said, what if he wasn't living in a cabin? What if he was like living, I don't know, in his car or something? Maybe a truck. You know, he sleeps out in the bed of his truck, you know, because we had a truck. And again, that's a perfect example. Like, just, you know, look around, see what you have. And the answer usually is just lying in front of you.
So when you were filming this as documentary style, did anybody come up to you and go, what are you guys doing? Because, I mean, you're filming all over campus. You're filming here. You guys must be getting interruptions all over the place.
Oh, yeah. So there are good interruptions and there are bad interruptions. Good interruptions are people who are so, like, they think this is all real. That's how convincing the performances were, thankfully. Like, we have a scene where there's this kind of a crazy Bible-thumping protester on the campus. Some students almost got into a fight with that actor because they thought he was real, right? And then I called Con. I said, guys, this is for a movie. They just stopped. You see the gears turning in their head. And they said, oh, that dude's a really good actor. So that's a good interruption. A bad interruption is when a security guard or a cop comes up to you and says, what are you guys doing here? What are you doing? That happened like 3 or 4 times. So not too many interruptions, not too many takes were ruined, but just enough to like, you know, get under our skin. Just enough.
Now, you have a lot of artwork throughout the film. I mean, pictures of Dr. Copernicus. Have you seen him? Now, did you guys actually – I do want to know, because you guys see you pasting them on things in the film. I clearly see you. Did anybody call a number or did anybody ask you about if this was real? Anything?
No, you know. People passed by us. They saw what we were doing and they just kind of, you know, would shrug their shoulders and move on. You know, again, that's when the security guards come up to you and ask, well, what are you guys doing, you know? But people just took it in stride. I would, you know, we would actually leave the posters up there for real. And then I would go back later to see if they were still there. Most of the time they weren't, unfortunately.
That's what I figured. I figured people kind of had an art style. People are like, oh, that's kind of cool. I'll take that home. So I'm always wondering, did you find these later on in life? You go to somebody's house, they have one there. You're like, I know what that is.
Well, I give those out to I gave all of my friends and stuff like free posters, you know, just as a little gift. And thankfully they have put them up in their walls and everything. That's just cool to see, you know.
Now, I do have to ask, since you're using the urban legend concept, do you believe in urban legends?
I mean, generally, no. I mean, there are some I think are more credible than others. I don't believe in like Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster or anything like that. But I am totally accepting of the idea that there are strange things out there that we haven't really fully discovered yet, you know.
So when you're doing your like big crowd scenes, I mean, you have a couple of them. Are those all your friends or did you just put up a sign saying, hey, I need some extras. Come on in.
We used a couple of sites. We used sites like Actors Access and Backstage to get our extras. And then, you know, a few friends would come in and help out with those scenes. But most of the actors you see there in the movie are not my friends or whatever. I mean, you know, they're professional actors.
Now, when you guys are shooting this, what type of camera is it? I mean, it looks like mainly you're holding them on your shoulder. I know you're not using dolly shots of any kind. I can't see anything. So are you just holding this on your shoulder the whole time and basically following them around? Or how is that working?
So I'm using a Sony AS7 II camera. And I'm just holding it in my hand, you know, no shoulder rig or anything like that. No fancy cage. It's just me holding that camera, you know, doing all the scenes as you see them in the movie. Very simple.
Really? So I'm shocked you didn't have an extra guy just to help you on a couple shots.
Yeah. So we would go through rehearsals, right? We would do a few rehearsals at least to figure out blocking and lighting and everything. We had a cinematographer and we were very careful about the look. You know, we did want it to look cinematic, even though it's, you know, a fake documentary. So we didn't want it to look sloppy, but we also didn't want it to look rehearsed. Right. So I didn't want to be carrying around a big shoulder rig because this is just a college student filming another college student. You know, you have to play with the kind of the context that you're in, right?
So, you know, since you're a very small film crew, you're probably not using a lot of lighting. At least I didn't see a lot of lighting, like extra lighting and shots. I mean, obviously, I know you're staging your shots to get the most light. Even the apartment scene, I thought you might have had some challenges. How was shooting at night? Because you do some night shooting, and I didn't see lights. So I was trying to figure out what were your challenges for that.
That's good. We definitely used some basic lighting. We used some basic lighting setups. We had an LED that we used for a few scenes in the apartment out there.
Okay.
In outdoor scenes. Actually, that was natural lighting. We used the street lamp above us. You know, we acted out the scenes closest to the street lamp that was there. But definitely no fancy lighting. Just a pretty basic setup for most of it. Now, a few scenes, I have an LED on the camera. You know, my character has that LED on his camera, so in scenes where, like, we're not using any other lighting other than that single LED on top of the camera that I'm using.
Now, did you find when writing your script, you knew this was pretty much going to be a two-man shot for the most time? I mean, obviously, scenes with Kat, there's three. Now, did you prep yourself ahead of time, getting your camera angles correctly to get those in, or did you know what shots you were going to use ahead of time?
Oh, it depended on the scene. Sometimes I would go in with already an idea of how we would shoot it. Other times we would figure it out and set. Definitely there are a lot of argument scenes between my character and the other lead character played by Alec. And those I preferred to actually like do a couple rehearsal takes and just, you know, feel it out. Right. Because that's when it's supposed to be the most spontaneous. There were a few shots, especially when we were getting B-roll that we'd actually storyboarded them out and, you know, talked about them ahead of time, because those are more stable shots in the universe of the film. So it was a mix.
So I do have to ask, I love your banter between you and Kat. I find it works really well. Are you guys good friends, or is she just coming in cold to this?
Oh, you know, she's an actress that I've worked with on previous projects. This was our third collaboration together. And, you know, I mean, some of it was in the script. Other, you know, I would allow for improvisation and just the right amount, you know, the right amount of improvisation. It's kind of like salt. You know, if you sprinkle it the right amount, it really does enhance, you know, the authenticity. It enhances the chemistry that's there between the characters. You know, we'd worked a couple times and,
And how many times did you work with Alec before? A lot, or is it your first time? And what two-part question. What directions did you give him? Because he seems very, I don't want to be sullen, but seems to be not emotional at times. You know what I mean? He just seems to do his own thing. So I think that's a direction coming from you, I see.
Interesting. So I have worked with Alec before this film. We did a short film. And I think the first time actually we worked together, I was his co-star in another person's project. And then he was the lead character in my previous short film. Then we did this. So we had developed a pretty good working relationship. Now for this character, it was very interesting because Alec read the script. We came in for a table read, and I saw what his interpretation of the character was. And I didn't want to force him to take my interpretation. I wanted to work with the energy that he was bringing, with the image that he saw this character. So I directed him from that. And he had a very intense portrayal as this character. You know, he could be explosive, or he could be very, you know, kind of, he could keep all of that emotion bottled up depending on the scene. And it was very fun playing with that, you know, playing with the levels, because Alec can either, he can go from 0 to 100 real quick. And that dynamic is so not just fun to work with as a director, but it just, it keeps you on your toes too, right? Because I'm also acting with him, and sometimes he would surprise me and bring out a better performance out of me too. So we had a very interesting working relationship as both a director and an actor and co-stars.
So did you feel like, I feel he's got the same performance pretty much the whole movie, which is fine. But in the last 20 minutes, he just ramps right after the closet, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. I find you go a different way after the closet.
The closet is a big turning point. You know, the way you have it set up is that my character is the one who actually goes through an arc, and Alec's character is tragic because he cannot change. Despite the obvious flaws in his character's personality, as much as people pointed out, he does not psychologically have the ability to change. So he can only ramp it up more, right? The more humiliation he suffers, the more rejection he suffers, the deeper he goes into this whole mythos of Professor Zerdonicus. And you get to that climax and, you know, it's either go home or go broke, you know. I guess that's the saying. I don't know if I said it right.
Yeah, I know. You're all good. How cold was the fountain? the water in the fountain. I don't know when you filmed this.
Ooh, you should ask Alec. We filmed that November. He did not complain. Alec is one of the most dedicated actors you can imagine. Like, he was so dedicated, it scared me. Like, there was nothing he would not do. There's nothing he was not game for. He jumped in the fountain once. He cut his big toe on, I guess, a little pebble inside the fountain. And then he did another take after that. Exactly, right? So, you know, on one hand, it's like, oh my God, like, we can, you know, we can take this performance anywhere. We can do anything. But it's also like, my responsibility as the director to make sure he didn't, you know, put himself in danger, because he was just game to do anything.
How many days did you shoot this for, and did you stay on your pattern of shooting?
We would shoot Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I think we in total shot, I want to say 8 weekends. Sounds about right. Then we would end up shooting some reshoots, some B-roll after that. So in total, I'd say there was – I'm trying to do math really quick in my head. There is around like 30 days of shooting in total.
Oh, okay. And the editing process must have been fun doing that much shooting. Cause I mean, you're pretty compact in this movie. Like, I don't find you've wasted any shots. Like, there's nothing I'd go back and say, hey, you could cut that. But no, it's pretty tight.
Yeah. So we had our first rough cut at around 100 minutes. And it was a little long. It was a little long, and minor details can actually make a big difference in terms of pacing, just how the movie feels. So once we cut those 10 minutes, the pacing just picks up, and, you know, we cut the fat off the movie, really, which was a big help. But the editing was done by my cinematographer, Lucio Vasquez. He's actually worked in documentaries before, so he was able to bring that experience to here to add that authenticity. The breakthrough for us is, at first we were just putting together the movie in just one, we wouldn't cut in our takes. You know what I mean? Like, we would film in one take. So we would find the best take and put it in there. We wouldn't cut at first. And then we just, you know, watching the very first cut, it was just like, this just doesn't flow, you know? And we realized, like, we need jump cuts. You know, we need, like, to – we can't just stay on this one moment forever. Like, we need to find some way to have more control over the pacing of our story.
So what you're saying is, as a director, pacing's the biggest issue for you then?
Well, I wouldn't say it was the biggest issue. I mean, it's the thing you got to pay the most attention to in your editing, because if you – get hung up on little details, you can miss the big picture. And, you know, bad pacing, you know, whatever other positive aspects a movie has, bad pacing can really just drag down the experience for anybody. So you do have to take that step back and just really take in the movie as a whole. So that's definitely the thing I paid attention to. Not the most, but, you know, you just have to have control over that.
I really enjoyed the end cap to this movie, and I can't tell anymore, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Was there a different plan for the end cap of the movie, or was it always going to be that?
Ooh, okay. I'll try to discuss this without getting into spoilers. So, yes, we had a couple different plans. Actually, the very first draft of this, that ending was not going to be the ending. There was going to be a good amount of story after that point. But writing the screenplay, I realized – this actually seems like the ending. Like, why not leave it here? And then, you know, me, Alec, and Lucio sat down and we figured it out, and we really ironed out the details of that ending. So, yeah, we had a couple different ideas before we came to that final conclusion.
Okay. I can't go into any more detail. I feel really bad, but we can discuss the music. I don't want to forget that. I find the music it's hidden. Like, you really got to listen for the music or you're going to miss it. So who did the music and why did you hide it so well?
I did the music, and it is as subtle as it is, because doing a found footage fake documentary, you don't want to – you want it to be cinematic. You want it to have layers that the audience can appreciate, but you also don't want anything to distract from what's going on in front of the camera. You know, John Carpenter once said that he feels like his scores are like wallpaper. You know, they're decorative, but it's not the first thing you notice. Now, I think his scores are much more aesthetic than that, but I would say that about, yeah, I would say that about the score in Zardonicus, which really is just something that fills out the background and does leave the character's action at the forefront.
Well, I'm not going to ruin anything for those. I enjoyed the ending song. I love the over the credit song. I thought it was great.
Oh, that song, that is interesting. So that, I have a friend who is in a band. I heard them play that song live and I said, you know, we're looking for a song for our, you know, end credits. Would you mind if we use that? They said, no, absolutely. So that was a lot of luck right there that I knew somebody who had a song like that. It really, really worked.
So I think I've covered everything. If I missed anything, please tell me, but I don't think so. I usually don't. So three fun questions for the end of your interview. Everybody gets them. I'm sorry. Your favorite film, please.
Oh God. Oh man. That's a hard one. You know, the one that I go with, I don't know if it's my favorite film, but I do think it's my Desert Island film. It's A Hard Day's Night starring the Beatles. That movie is just the ultimate hangout movie to me. Like that movie just permeates fun and enjoyment. And I mean, it stars the Beatles, who are like some of the most like profound artists of all time in both their work and their personalities, but they truly have more chemistry amongst themselves than any set of actors that I've seen in any other film. The movie has this great, subtle, great dry wit sense of humor, very British humor, pretty sophisticated, I would say, for most star vehicles are very cheap, you know, very, usually the rush through and just done for the star's ego. But this was a real movie taking advantage of, the fact that the Beatles were, you know, at the height of their fame. They were their height of, you know, the peak of their success. And I don't know. I just feel like their charisma permeates the entire film. Yeah. Yeah.
One film you've never seen and should have?
Oh God, that's a lot of movies. That's a lot of movies.
You can pick one. I'm sure there's one you should have seen. Oh, Godfather.
Thankfully I've seen that. I'm trying to think. There are movies that people will say to me, how have you not seen that before? And I'll just say, I'm sorry. I'm trying to think within the horror genre, because that's typically my bread and butter. You know, I have not seen The Ring, either the original or the remake.
You'll be in for a treat when you get to it. I'll leave it at that.
All right.
So Texas is known for its beef. So I need to know your favorite burger place.
Well, it's not Whataburger. I'm not a Whataburger fanboy. We have some terrific barbecue places down here and some terrific burger places. Just a hamburger wise, I don't know if you have these in Canada. We have the Burger Joint down here. Do you have those in Canada?
We do not.
Okay. The Burger Joint, it's a chain. We have a couple locations in Texas. Best burgers, best fries, best milkshakes. That's like my reward place. Whenever I feel good, I go there to celebrate.
So before I let you go, where can everybody find your wonderful film?
The Curse of Professor Zardonicus is streaming on Amazon Prime.
Thank you for your time and have a great night.
You too. Thank you for having me.